This RN podcast has been handmade by Radio Artisans. Hello, I'm Richard Aidy. Don't forget the media report. Download it for your weekly media hit. You'll find it at the Radio National website.
Hi, I'm Cassie McCullough and welcome to The List, your weekly pop culture pit stop.
And I'm Jason DeRosso. And yes, this is the time of the week when you get to pump up your tyres, top up your coolant and make sure you're roadworthy for a trip on the pop culture highway.
Today, is there nowhere to hide in the digital age? These days it seems your social media profile begins when you folks share your ultrasound on Facebook.
And death is no reason to log off, with services that continue your social media presence after you die.
And also, the moment Game of Thrones tragics have been waiting for is almost here.
Man who fights for gold can't afford to lose to a girl.
I want to fight for the side that fights for the living.
Season 3 of the mega hit airs this weekend. But what is it about this new form of TV that has captured the world's imagination?
That's just some of the things coming up on The List.
And now to our first guest, a man who's done a lot of research into online identity, but not the one that you normally think of. It's the online identity that precedes our entrance into the world, the one that is already present online before we're actually born. And he's also done some research into online identity after death. His name is Tama Lever, and he's joining us from Perth, where he works as a lecturer in the Internet Studies Department at Curtin University. Hi, Tama.
Hi, Tama.
Hi, great to speak with you.
Now, you were first interested in this when you noticed how many ultrasound pictures people were posting online of their unborn babies. Tell us what you found, first of all, and what struck you about the ethics of this situation.
Well, what I was really interested in is to see how many people were sharing images in a way that sort of that euphoric sort of first image of the first ultrasound when you sort of clap eyes onto this sort of black and white image of somebody that will eventually become one of the most important people in your lives. And I was really interested in the immediacy of sharing that. So looking at the way that people were using mobile devices in particular and tracking the amount of ultrasound pictures that were going up using the Instagram service. And just a rudimentary search pulled up more than 42,000 ultrasound images. Now, of course, not all of the ultrasounds were baby picture or pre-baby pictures, as it were, but a significant proportion were. And what was interesting was that just as the way that ultrasounds are set up, when you look at the image, you often see the mother's full name, you see the date, you see the size of the baby, you see the estimated date of arrival. And people were taking pictures usually with their smartphones and sharing that often publicly with the world. Certainly the ones that I could see were being shared publicly, possibly with no real thought through to how that will last, how that particular image will perhaps be the very first and one of the most important images of this person when they emerge into the world, and how long that image has the potential to last.
Yeah, I've had a couple of friends announce their pregnancies on Facebook by posting the ultrasound. It is kind of exciting. It's here it is. It really exists. It's empirical evidence. But you're disturbed not by so much the intrusion into the baby's privacy and the I guess the sort of emotional and moral questions as the potential for down the track there's going to be some blowback.
Absolutely. I mean, we are entering a point where when kids, say, turn 10 or 11 or 12, when they really get to start fashioning their own identity in a meaningful way online, they are going to be confronted with possibly hundreds or even thousands of pictures and other fragments about their lives that their parents have shared. Now, as parents, people are usually quite well schooled in being worried about what their kids might be sharing online, but the inverse isn't really true. We don't do a terribly good job of preparing parents to think about how what they're sharing shapes their kids' identities, and where it's starting to see that moment where kids are turning around saying, look, I want all of this stuff gone. I want it behind privacy walls or deleted. I don't want videos on YouTube or pictures on Instagram or Facebook or anywhere else. I want the ability to fashion my own identity. And that's going to be a real friction moment, I think, for parents and teens in the coming years.
There is also quite a lot of information that we can glean just from the kind of photographic element of the ultrasound picture as well, like just looking at various bone placements and things. Who knows what we could what we'll decide we can actually glean from these shots in future years as well.
People might be denied health insurance, you mean, like some kind of actual revealing of a disease or something.
Yeah, some sort of, yes, exactly.
Absolutely. I mean, I guess that sort of harks back to the film Gattaca, which sort of really raises those issues where information gets used in different ways and people get a bit older. But it's also very true that we, when we share things online, we often have an extremely sort of present-centred idea of it. If we're sharing something on Instagram, perhaps, at one point at least, Instagram was, experientially at least, it felt private because only people with other mobile phones could get an account and see it. But at no point was it technically private. Now that Instagram, for example, has a web interface and can feed straight into Facebook, these things that we might have thought of as private are very, very public. It's also the case, of course, that while we might presume that text in a photograph isn't text in the classical sense of being searchable, the technologies that will read the text in an image and convert that into searchable text are coming along at such a pace that we really can't rely on the limitations of today to be there for the entire duration of our offspring's lives.
I'm just thinking about poor Elvis Presley and how his life was raked over so closely, and even of a website called Americans for Cloning Elvis. Like, if you, that's the kind of thing you're talking about, isn't it? That 20 years from now, the Britney Spears of the time, we're going to see pictures of her naked in the bath as a toddler with her siblings, or running down a beach eating an ice cream, or those kinds of things, and there'll be no control, because organisations such as Facebook are businesses with very uncertain future models. We won't know what kind of conditions our material will be subject to.
Absolutely. And for the most part, a lot of people, and myself included at times, aren't overly concerned about those future conditions. It's the joy of sharing something. When you see your kids do something amazing, you take that picture and you want to share it with the world, and that's perfectly understandable. But the downside is that the tools that we're using to share are indeed, as you say, corporately owned giants that are trying desperately to work out how to make money off all of these tiny fragments.
Mm. It seems that we've done much more thinking about the other end of life than we have about the beginning, because many of the social media networks do have very formal policies about what happens to accounts after someone dies and who is allowed to have any control over those accounts and whether they are memorialised or continue. Are you comfortable with the way provisions are made in those cases?
Oh, not at all, not yet. I think a lot of companies have got something on the books because of some sort of moral backlash where Facebook, for example, when they started doing friend suggestions in the top right-hand corner, people were seeing people that they knew to be dead. And Facebook at that time had no mechanism for figuring out what to do with the account of somebody who had passed away. So they have an incredibly rudimentary tool, which is either family members can request for an account to be deleted or for an account to be memorialised. That's a pretty blunt set of choices, if you like, especially for a space where Facebook is all about curation, about performing selves, if you like. The idea that nobody can go in and help curate that final performance is actually quite worrying. Mm.
You mentioned the idea of social media being about a performance, an online performance of self. And, of course, there is a growing now desire to sort of codify that performance of self after death, isn't there? I mean, there's a segment of the market where online services are being offered for people who actually want to keep Facebooking, updating their status and so forth from the grave, and even they even want to be tweeting from beyond the grave. And there are a couple of companies that are starting to offer this service. Dead Social's one of them. Let's hear a little bit about what they offer.
Meet Gabriel. One day, Gabriel suddenly became ill and left this world for a better place. Before parting, Gabriel created a Dead Social account. Dead Social allows anyone to create timed Facebook messages. These are activated soon after a user dies and can be sent out for years to come. Gabriel's friends, wife, and even his grandson still receive messages from Gabriel. His widow is also the recipient of an inappropriate joke from time to time.
It's just so weird.
Tama, what are your thoughts on this growing service?
I certainly can see the appeal of Dead Social, the idea of being able to have, if you like, the last laugh of leaving a few last messages, or even dealing with a few unresolved issues in your life that you want someone to remember that you had feelings about even after you've passed away. I can certainly see the appeal. I think it must be incredibly macabre to receive one of those emails, though.
But there is a predictive service available also, right, that works on algorithms that looks back at what you posted when you were alive and kind of tries to imagine what you would post into the future after death.
Absolutely. So this, and this is brand new, and we haven't seen a lot of evidence of it working brilliantly well yet. But LivesOn is a service that, if you allow to see your tweets as you're making them while you're alive, in theory, that they've got a fairly dumb artificial intelligence algorithm that should learn how you tweet. And if it learns enough across a period of time, then in theory, you can bequeath that and it can basically post on your behalf until somebody turns it off.
Well, this idea just lends itself to fiction, I think. And Charlie Brooker has done just that.
Yeah, that's right, with his Black Mirror series, which is he's done two series, and the most recent one aired in the UK in February. And one of the episodes was about a woman whose partner dies, and two things happen after that. She discovers she's pregnant and that she can sign up for this service which recreates her partner through analysing his social media, etc., and she can have a virtual relationship with him. She can also take the next step, which is having him cloned, which she does.
I know he's dead, but I can sign you up to something that helps. It will let you speak to him. And don't worry, you won't even have to do anything. I'll just assign...
Shut up!
You click the link and you talk to it.
And it mimics him.
And reads through all the things they've ever said online. The more it has, the more it's him.
So... how am I sounding?
You sound just like him.
This might sound a bit creepy. There's another level to this available.
Certainly sounds creepy to me.
Sure does. Tom, what do you make of it?
I think it's a fantastically evocative episode, and it does exactly that. It's takes the logic of the various sort of services like LivesOn and Dead Social and takes them to their next step. But I think that the most evocative thing about the episode was the closer you get to reality, the more disconcerting it is. It's a bit like what's called the uncanny valley in animation. The closer something is to looking real, it's those tiny imperfections that really jut against your perception. And I think that's a bit like what this episode suggests. The closer we get to sort of reanimating the dead through social media, the more disconcerting it's going to be.
And that was Tama Lever, lecturer in the Department of Internet Studies at Perth's Curtin University. And you're listening to The List, RN's weekly pop culture discussion. My name is Jason DeRosso, and with me is co-host Cassie McCullough.
And also with us today is Sydney-based writer and dramaturg Tom Wright. Hi, Tom.
Hi, nice to be on The List again.
Hi, Jason.
Now, we can't call you a fan of Game of Thrones, Tom, but we may call you a student.
Yes, it's an interesting distinction, isn't it, between the fan and the student. The fan is someone who gives their heart and soul to a particular genre, and I find it fascinating to watch from afar, but I could never describe myself as immersed in quite the same way as a true acolyte of the game.
It's true. It is true that many, many people around the world are fans, and in fact it's quite cultish, the following that this TV series by HBO has. In case you don't know, the much-awaited first episode of Season 3 is about to arrive on Australian screens. Previously, it's been the most downloaded, pirated show in Australian history. This time round, Showcase has done something quite clever. They're fast-tracking it, so it's only 2 hours, the delay between the American screening and the Australian one. So it's going to air on pay TV on Easter Monday at 4:20 in the afternoon. Who knows whether this strategy will work? It'll be interesting to see. But Game of Thrones is certainly part of this much broader phenomenon, which is being referred to as binge TV, where people will watch one episode and then not be able to stop. And in fact, when I first came across Game of Thrones, rather stupidly, I put it on at about 11 o'clock at night, and I did see the dawn of the next day as it went right through season one.
We shouldn't apologise for this. The phenomenon of the book that you can't put down has been used as a tag for generations, and now we've got the television show that you can't switch off, and they're deliberately constructed as such. And perhaps if we'd been able to have box sets going back to the 1950s, we'd have been watching television this way always.
Yeah, which does pose the problem for newbies like me. I'm kind of new to Game of Thrones. If you come in late, it's actually rather difficult. So you are actually, as you say, Tom, you're actually forced to kind of begin at the beginning and kind of see it through. And this is, you know, we're talking about hours of TV watching, obviously. It's not the only series, but yeah.
Yeah, and in fact, the phenomenon of binge TV has been made fun of by those crazy folks from Portlandia, Carrie and Fred, who in season two began watching one episode of Battlestar Galactica just before they were supposed to go out to a friend's birthday. And so, of course, they managed to make their way right through the entire back catalogue of Battlestar Galactica. They lose their jobs, their power gets cut off, and they end up hunting down the creator of Battlestar Galactica to beg him to write more, which is kind of it sounds ridiculous, but it's almost what's happened to George R.R. Martin, the author of the Game of Thrones series, which is called A Song of Fire and Ice.
Well, and a Game of Thrones originally, and in the television version, Game of Thrones, which is an interesting sort of movement in itself. If you go online or you go to Amazon or you go to any of the response sites, the fans are almost hectoring Martin to keep writing, and it's as if he's toying with the fan base about exactly at what point and how he's going to be releasing the material and how he's going to be writing new plot lines. It's all game theory in the end.
But what is it that makes it so popular? It's I mean, for people who don't know much about it, it looks more or less like a kind of high fantasy soap opera. How I've come to it, as I mentioned earlier, late, but I do find it compelling. But what is it? What are the key ingredients that are making it so compelling?
Well, this is perhaps we should unpack it just a little bit. It obviously comes out of the fantasy genre as a piece of television and as a piece of writing, and fantasy traditionally constitutes of a recognisable, ordered, real world into which metaphysical elements intrude as a kind of plot device. And one of the interesting things that we can say from the outset about Game of Thrones is that the metaphysical side of things is actually quite often an adjunct to or little more than set dressing to the core plotting. If you actually look at Game of Thrones over the first two series, going into the third series, it's largely about politics. It's actually largely about the way human societies organise themselves. And it made me think, as I watched it, particularly as we go into the complexities of the third series that we're about to hit, is that it's an American vision of how the rest of the world works in many ways. It's sort of like Somalia or Afghanistan, these warring states of warring tribal lords where the throne in question is power and authority. And the Americans have a firm and Martin's very much an exemplar of this sort of narrative, have a firm belief in their own stability and their constitutional superiority. And this is a vision of the old world. It's a new world vision of how the old world works, both aesthetically, so it's got all of the trappings of age and of medievalism and so on, but also the age of chaos, which modern sort of industrial world has managed to escape from, and yet perversely this particular American form has a yearning for. And that's because it's American, it's actually deeply rationalist. And so the metaphysical elements, dragons or weird arachnid creatures that emerge out of eggs or ghosts or White Walkers or any of these other Game of Thrones fantasy creations, in the end, after a while, to start to feel like dressing for the core human and humanist problems. So I would say it's not actually a masterwork of fantasy, but it's a very interesting piece of American television.
Yeah, the world of Westeros, I like the idea of that being like a Europe or an Africa. There's also the external threat, which this world doesn't really know about, and that's winter. Winter is coming from the north, and this is a foreboding threat throughout the series, not yet realised. The zombie ice zombies, the White Walkers, are coming down.
Sure, exemplars of climate change. It's kind of a climate change anxiety narrative at work there, where the world is about to come crashing down in a new ice age.
And it's no coincidence, and I think that John Lanchester in the London Review of Books points out that this narrative came at a time when most of the world was in a dreadful economic state. And the idea that winter was coming was also about an economic anxiety.
Yeah, and also because winter is not like our winter. It's not a clearly defined season. It could last
10 years.
No one knows how long it will
last. It's a winter of the soul.
There's that sense of how long will this current economic depression last and so forth. But look, it is highly dramatic and very compelling just on that basis too. Let's get a taste of it.
There's a beast in every man. And it stirs when you put a sword in his hand.
I've won every battle, but I'm losing this war.
He would see this country burn if he could be king of the ashes.
Now, that's just from the trailers that everyone's been able to see for the last couple of months online. We have been lucky enough to see the first two episodes of the new series, but we can't even bring you audio of that for fear of a $250,000 fine and 5 years in jail, which I don't know.
Ice zombies, apparently, that are going to be unleashed.
It's almost worth it, but, you know. But, yeah, the central drama continues. What did you make of it, Tom? Do you like what you've seen?
What we're talking about before in terms of sort of box set or binge TV, it's very clearly going into the first couple of episodes of the next series is that it does predicate itself completely on familiarity with the plot lines. Mm. I mean, even if you take that traditional HBO 10-second stinger of what you've missed before, you just go straight into it. And one of the strengths and or weaknesses, depending on your perspective of Game of Thrones, is that in order to have some fealty to Martin's vision, six or seven and sometimes up to eight different plot lines have to be served on a regular basis. And so after a while, it starts to feel like the show is just playing catch-up all the time, continually saying, and this particular gang wandering in this particular landscape, we haven't forgotten them, don't worry, they're still happening. And so after it takes a while to get going, but it's made the quite legitimate bet that the devotees are so into it that they'll put up with this.
But what is really great about the plotting too is that obviously it's very intricate, and so therefore you invest so much in the characters and in various storylines. But then the series does something reasonably innovative, and that is it suddenly cuts people's lives short, cuts people's storylines short, and that's all quite unpredictable, isn't it?
It's one of the best things about what Martin does is he's not afraid to be brutal to his characters, and he will actually treat them quite harshly. He also will play with expectations of how long a particular character's life is going to work. You know how you instinctively sometimes, if you understand the genre, you can feel the way in which it's unfolding, and your ability to play with that is something that the TV version's been able to pick up and accentuate even further. So you get wound up into ballet. Well, the classic instance was in first series where Ned Stark's established and Sean Bean's playing it, and the whole point about it, you feel like he's the protagonist for the entire series, and just at the moment when you expect there to be a plot turn for the people who didn't know the story, you know, he loses his head. So that sense of brutality.
Spoiler alert.
Oh, no, this is first series. I think we can spoil first series.
Yeah, well, this is George R. R. Martin's real trademark. We're so well trained in expecting there to be a last minute reprieve or we know what the outcome is going to be, and we're really just joining the dots. And he doesn't deliver that. What he delivers is a constant sense of forward motion. And you were saying that you felt like a lot of those sections were too long with each individual story. But what that seems to create is an entirely different rhythm.
And it has an ancient basis. That's exactly how the Norse sagas and the great tales of the North work, is that there's not a sense necessarily of a particular story knowing how it's going to end. It comes out of an oral tradition, which is one of the things that feels most authentic about the television show, is that you feel like you belong to something that comes out of an oral tradition where, and this happened, and this happened, and this happened, and it's not necessarily all constructed according to some Hollywood manual of perfect plot construction. I actually kind of like that, but on occasions you do feel like you're watching characters referring to events from the past over and over again, and there's very little real-time action.
Exposition.
Oh, and what your grandfather said to mine and so on, it's interesting.
The other thing that strikes you about it is that there's so much sex in it. It's explicit.
Oh, you noticed that, did you?
I did notice it. And, you know, and there's some quite twisted representations of sex. I mean, incest in particular figures as a theme that just recurs and recurs.
And violence.
And there's a sense, from an American perspective, that it's a rebellion against the Puritan history of American television. By being on cable, they're free from the censorship that sort of plagued American television for many decades, and now overcompensating in the other direction, waving their adult flag so the whole thing doesn't feel like it's trapped in the world of 12-year-old geeks.
Yeah, well, it's definitely out of safe territory, that's for sure. Well, you know, if there's a tension between people who haven't seen Game of Thrones and people who have, there's also a tension between people who've seen the series but not read the books.
Philistines.
Look, I only got through one. I thought, my life is too short, I can't do the rest of them.
Well, but in some ways it's better as television than it is, because the writing, to be fair, but objective literarily, isn't great.
And it's interesting that Martin was actually a writer for television. He even worked on The Twilight Zone. So he came from a television background before writing the books, and now his books return to television. I think there's some sort of logic there.
But there will always be prestige, won't there, in reading the books?
Oh, yes. And this is where the Access of Awesome come in. Now, they're an Australian comedy band, and this week they posted on YouTube a clip for their song called Rage of Thrones. And a warning, there is some language ahead. You got a new favourite show, been watching HBO. You got a new favourite show, it's called Game of Thrones. Well, I read the fucking books! I said I read the fucking books! I read them years ago, so don't tell me about Jon Snow, 'cause I already know. I've got a signed copy of A Feast for Crows, then a 6-year wait for A Dance with Dragons, a 6-year wait for A Dance with Dragons. Waited 6 fucking years for A Dance with Dragons, and now you jump on the fucking bandwagon! Yeah. So there you go, Access of Awesome and Rage of Thrones. A very angry George R.R. Martin fan there.
All right, well, now on the list, it's that time for our weekly obsessions. What have we been obsessing about? What can we not get out of our heads this week? First to you, Tom.
I've been reading Jared Diamond, who I know is quite a popular writer and has been writing since the 90s about everything from anthropology through to the collapse of civilizations, but I've come to him quite late. And I realise why he's so powerful, because he can summarise big human and big popular themes such as environmental catastrophe or why particular societies come into decay with a great deal of wit and accessibility. So I'd heartily recommend his book, particularly his book Collapse, and the way in which he describes something like Easter Island and how it went from being an empire to falling apart. Absolutely riveting.
To you, Cassie McCullough, what have you been obsessing about?
Look, I'm still recovering from a 2-part series that I watched on the ABC called Kangaroo Dundee, about a 6'7".
That was fascinating. So many people noticed that, yeah.
It's really freaked me out. It's a 6'7" Australian guy who lives in Alice Springs, in case you haven't seen it. His name's Brolgo, and he looks after Joey's. But his relationship with them is quite bizarre.
Mm. It was a bit odd, wasn't it?
Physically bizarre?
Yeah. He's really far too intimate with them, I feel.
Paint that mental picture.
I really won't, but you can see both episodes on iView.
He's involved, I
believe. Okay, okay, look. That's right.
They're his babies, Jason. Okay.
Sorry.
He allows them to drink his saliva. He has them in his bed. It's all very... I mean, he's a wonderfully caring person, but...
It's taken Steve Irwin to his logical conclusion.
I felt like I needed psychotherapy after watching it. It's on iView until April 4.
Just briefly, my obsession is a blog by an American academic by the name of Robin James. The blog is called It's Her Factory. And basically, look, it looks at pop culture, but especially pop music through the prism of philosophy. But it's not just looking at songs as in that kind of literary sense as a text, but also she looks at chords and music. And she's got this most recent post is about Rihanna. Really worth a look. It's Her Factory is the blog's name.
Sounds great.
And that's it for another week on the list. Thanks very much to our guest today, Tom Wright.
Yeah, thank you. Tom. Tom Wright is a Sydney-based dramaturg and writer. And if you want to catch up with any of the things that we've been speaking about on the program, check out our webpage. We always put heaps of links there.
Yes, just go to abc.net.au/rn and follow the links to the list, where you'll also be able to leave comments or download or stream the show. Maybe you can stream it to your phone. Well, that's it for another show. I'm Jason DeRosso, signing off.
And I'm Cassie McCullough. See you next week.